Imagine yourself in this hypothetical scenario. It's a dark and stormy night, and you're driving down the road as a tornado is approaching. As you drive past a bus stop, three people are standing at this bus stop in the line of danger. There's an old woman who looks like she's having a medical emergency and needs to be rushed to the hospital, number one. Number two, you see there at the bus stop an old friend of yours who once saved your life. This would be your chance to repay him. Number three, at the bus stop is the man or woman of your dreams, the one you've been waiting for your entire life, and this might be your only chance to meet them. Suppose you're driving a sports car and have just one passenger seat. So you can only pick up one of these three people and whisk them away. Who would you choose? How many say, "I would offer a ride to the hospital to the old lady"? Raise your hand. A few. How many say, "I would take this opportunity to repay my old friend who once saved my life and offer him a ride"? About evenly divided. How many say, "Forget those two people, I'm going to pick up the man or woman of my dreams"? Raise your hand. All right, Janice is not very noble, but she's honest, right? That actual hypothetical scenario appeared as a question on a job application. A company was looking to hire someone to an important position. They ended up with 200 applicants for that position. Guess how the person who won the position responded to that question. He said, "I would give my car keys to my old friend, have him take the old woman to the hospital, and I would wait at the bus stop with the woman of my dreams." Brilliant, right? Wouldn't it be great if life was always like that? A neat solution to every problem that would give us what we want while still meeting the needs of those around us. Unfortunately, that's not what life is like. Life often backs us into a corner and forces us to make really tough choices between our narrow self-interest and the greater good. In those moments, how will we respond? That's what we're going to wrestle with today as we come to the third installment in our sermon series, Who Killed Jesus? As you know, the goal of this sermon series is to determine who bears ultimate responsibility for the death of Jesus. Today we come to our third suspect, someone who found himself backed into a corner and had to make a really tough decision. Today's suspect is Pontius Pilate. Let's pray. God, what makes the difference between people who rise to the occasion and those who don't? When life throws down the gauntlet and challenges us to acts of greatness, what will we do? Today, teach us something that will help us to be better prepared to meet our moments. We ask in the name of Jesus. Amen. In the year A.D. 26, Roman Emperor Tiberius Caesar appointed a fellow Italian, Pontius Pilate, to serve as governor over a far-flung Middle Eastern region ruled by Rome, a region known as Judea and Samaria, which included the city of Jerusalem and much of what we today call Israel. As governor of Judea and Samaria, Pontius Pilate was responsible for collecting taxes, for overseeing infrastructure projects, for maintaining law and order, and Above all else, he was responsible for preventing insurrections against the Roman government. To back up his authority, he had 3,000 Roman soldiers under his command. As governor, he was the only government official who could impose the death penalty against a criminal. Somewhere around the year 33 AD, as thousands of pilgrims flocked into the city of Jerusalem to celebrate the festival of the Passover, when Pilate and his many soldiers would have been on high alert for any hints of signs of insurrection, the institutional religious leaders in Jerusalem showed up outside Pilate's palace with someone they had arrested and claimed was a dangerous insurrectionist, Jesus of Nazareth. They told Pontius Pilate that this arrestee claimed to be the king of the Jews. If that were true, that would be a direct challenge to Roman rule. So Pilate interrogated Jesus. Pontius Pilate asked him, "Are you the king of the Jews?" Jesus responded, "My kingdom is not from this world. If my kingdom were from this world, my followers would be fighting to keep me from being handed over. But as it is, my kingdom is not from here." Pilate weighed the evidence and concluded that Jesus was innocent. He told the religious leaders, "I find no case against him," and proposed to release him. The religious leaders instead insisted that Pilate release Barabbas. Now, Barabbas was a bandit and probably a genuine insurrectionist. To appease the religious leaders, Pilate had Jesus flogged. And after he was beaten to a pulp, he offered to release Jesus again. That's when the religious leaders told Pilate, "Not only does this man claim to be the king of the Jews, this Jesus claims to be Son of God." Our text tells us, "Now when Pilate heard this, he was more afraid than ever. He entered his headquarters and asked Jesus, 'Where are you from?' Jesus gave him no answer. From then on, Pilate tried to release him, but that's when the religious leaders decided to play their trump card. They said to Pontius Pilate, 'If you release this man, you are no friend of the emperor. Everyone who claims to be a king sets himself up against the emperor.'" In other words, the implied threat was, if you release Jesus, if you don't execute this Jesus, we're going to tell the emperor that you are coddling and protecting insurrectionists. Matthew 27, 24, when Pilate saw that he could do nothing, but rather that a riot was beginning, he took some water, washed his hands before the crowd, saying, "I am innocent of this man's blood. See to it yourselves." So he released Barabbas for them and handed Jesus over to be crucified. What is fascinating to me about this story is that Pontius Pilate isn't the kind of aggressive, bloodthirsty, proactively evil person we often imagine him to be. In this story, it's clear that Pilate concluded that Jesus was innocent, and it's clear that Pilate didn't want to execute an innocent man. But as soon as the religious leaders threatened to complain to the emperor, as soon as Pilate's self-interest was pitted against the life of this innocent man, Pilate quickly folded. He wasn't going to risk his position of power and privilege to save the life of an innocent man. I can hear right now what Pilate must have been thinking. What they're doing here, these religious leaders, it's a shame. But what am I going to do? I'm not going to risk my neck for the sake of some Jewish mystic who thinks he's got a kingdom in another world. So you see, Pilate's great sin wasn't proactive, aggressive, evil. Pilate's great sin was indifference. A dangerous cocktail of indifference mingled with lack of courage. What are you going to do? This is not my fight. I wash my hands of the matter. You're probably, you've no doubt heard the name Elie Wiesel. Elie Wiesel was, and his family were brutalized, experienced all sorts of horrific things during the Nazi Holocaust. In Wiesel's largely autobiographical novel that he wrote years later, a novel called The Town Beyond the Wall, his main character, Michael, is someone who, like Wiesel, he and his family experienced all kinds of horror and brutality during the Nazi Holocaust. Michael, too, was Jewish. Michael, years after the Holocaust, decides to return to his hometown in Hungary to try to process the grief and the trauma that he experienced there. As he's walking around town and seeing all of these old sights and experiencing all these flashback memories, Michael is surprised that his most haunting memories are not of the brutal prison guards and executioners. No, his most haunting memory is of a neighbor who lived across the street from the synagogue. And in the days when the Nazis, day after day, were rounding up dozens of Jews as they came out of synagogue and putting them on death trains, Michael remembered how his neighbor would often stand in the picture window of his front room, gazing out the window, watching what was taking place. And the thing Michael says is that the man's face betrayed no pity, no pleasure, no shock. Not even anger or interest. Impassive, cold, impersonal. He just stood there looking out the window. Impassively watching. Remembering this, Michael concludes that the greatest sin a human being can commit is indifference. Elie Wiesel, speaking through his character Michael, puts it this way. To be indifferent, for whatever reason, is to deny not only the validity of existence, but also its beauty. Betray, and you're human. Torture your neighbor, you're still a human. Evil is human, we understand that. Weakness is human. Indifference is not. We often simplistically picture the world as being comprised of two kinds of people. There are good people over here, and there are bad people over here. What Wiesel is suggesting in his novel is that life's more complicated than that. There's an actual third category of people, far more numerous than the good people and the bad people, that stand in betwixt the two and often decisively tip the balance toward evil in the world. That middle category being indifferent spectators. People who stand and impassively watch as terrible things happen. If those spectators would join with the good people, evil could be stopped. But when they don't, evil is allowed to prevail. And the balance tips in favor. Indifferent spectators are the great enablers of evil in the world. Because of people like that, think Pontius Pilate, Jesus Christ was crucified. Because of people like that, the Holocaust was able to occur. Because of indifferent spectators, there are millions of children in our world today who go hungry. Because of indifferent spectators, our climate is crashing around us, and on the list goes. As people of faith, God calls upon us to get off the sidelines and do something. Don't just stand there. Don't just watch and shake your head and think, oh, isn't it a shame what they're doing? Do something. Take a risk. Don't make Pontius Pilate's mistake. Okay, that's a little heavy, right? Because we all know there's a part of us that often is indifferent. So let's lighten the mood for a second, take a breath, and then we can dig a little deeper. Once upon a time, there was a dog who died and went to heaven, as all dogs do, of course. As the dog was at the gates of heaven, the dog looks up and sees God on his throne. God says to the dog, "Before I let you in, I have to ask you one question. What do you believe in?" The dog says, "I believe in doing good by befriending people, keeping them company and reassuring them that they are loved and not alone." God says, "That is beautiful. Come on in." Not long after that, a pet rabbit dies and finds itself at the pearly gates, as is often the case. The rabbit looks up, sees God on the throne. God says, "I have to ask you one question before you enter. What do you believe?" The rabbit says, "I believe in making little children laugh and teaching them to be gentle and to responsibly care for all of your creatures, God." God says, "That is lovely. Come on in." Not long after that, a cat died and found itself at the pearly gates. God is stunned because, as we all know, most cats don't go to heaven. I'm just saying. As the cat's standing there, the cat looks up and sees God on the throne, and God says, "There's a question I have to ask you before you can get in. What do you believe?" Without skipping a beat, the cat says, "I believe you're in my chair." The moral of the story being, if you want to be a genuinely good person or cat, you have to believe in something that is greater than yourself. You have to rise above yourself. And that which is comfortable and convenient and in your narrow self-interest, and summon courage to dare to do risky things and to make sacrifices. That's what it means to be fully human, to dare to get involved, to be who and what God has created each one of us to be. God put us here on earth, us human beings, and entrusted us with all kinds of power to influence what happens down here for better or worse. We were put here to make a difference. We can't be sitting on the sidelines. Have you ever heard the name John Fryer? Probably not. But John Fryer changed the world. Here's a picture of John Fryer. He's the one on the far right wearing the mask. What? Let me explain. A couple months ago in May, I read an article in the New York Times, first time I'd ever heard of this guy, John Fryer. Let me share with you some of what the article in the Times said. On the second day of the annual convention of the American Psychiatric Association in 1972, something extraordinary happened. While the assembled psychiatrists, mostly white men in dark suits, settled into rows of chairs in the Danish room of the Adolphus Hotel in Dallas, a disguised figure had been smuggled through the back corridors. At the last minute, he stepped through a side curtain and took his place at the front of the room. There was an intake of breath in the audience. The man's appearance was grotesque. His face was covered by a rubber Nixon mask, and what he was wearing was garish, an oversized tuxedo and a curly fright wig. But the outlandishness of his outfit diminished in importance once he began to speak to the assembled psychiatrists. His first words were, "I am a homosexual, and I am a psychiatrist. For the next 10 minutes, Henry Anonymous, MD, that's what he asked to be called, described the secret world of gay psychiatrists. Officially, they didn't exist because, after all, homosexuality was still categorized as a mental illness. So acknowledging that you were one of them would result in the revocation of one's medical license and the loss of a career. In 42 states, sodomy was a crime. The reality, Fryer went on to tell the assembled psychiatrists, was that there were plenty of gay people in the APA, psychiatry's most influential professional body. They lived in hiding, he told them. We conceal every trace of our private life from our colleagues. Quote, all of us, homosexuals, have something to lose. We may not be considered for a professorship, or the colleague down the street may stop referring clients to us, or our supervisor may ask us to take a leave of absence. This was the trade-off that had formed the basis of the masked man's life as a psychiatrist. But the cost was too high. That's what he had come to tell them. He said, quote, we are taking an even bigger risk and not living fully our humanity. This is the greatest loss, our honest humanity. And then he took his seat to a standing ovation. The 10-minute speech delivered 50 years ago, the Times says, was a tipping point in the history of gay rights. The following year, the APA announced that it would reverse its nearly century-old position, declaring now that homosexuality was no longer a mental disorder. It's rare, the Times says, for psychiatrists to transform the culture that surrounds them, but that's what happened in 1972 and 1973. By removing the diagnosis from the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, or DSM, psychiatry removed the legal basis for a wide range of discriminatory practices for denying gay people the right to employment, citizenship, housing, and the custody of children. For excluding them from clergy, military, and the institution of marriage. After Fryer's speech and the APA's response, the long process of rolling back those practices could now begin. So that in 10 minutes of courage, one man changed the course of history. What's ironic is that at first, Fryer refused to do it. You see, gay activists who were preparing for the 1972 APA convention were planning to protest and picket outside the convention center, but it occurred to one of them that wouldn't it be far more effective if we could get one of the closeted gay psychiatrists to actually speak to their colleagues as a peer and explain things to them. And so these activists started asking every closeted gay psychiatrist that they knew, would you be willing to appear in front of your colleagues and explain who you are and the situation that we face? And one closeted psychiatrist after another said, no, 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 no. There's too much professional risk. There's too much personal risk. Somebody might recognize my voice even if I wear a mask. Somebody might out me and I could lose my job. Or somebody might come to my home and violently attack and kill me. When they approached John Fryer and said, would you do it? He said, no. But one of the activists kept in touch with Fryer over the weeks as they were trying to recruit someone and kept calling Fryer every time someone else said no and said, well, so-and-so told us no too, and so-and-so told us no too. And that really started to bother John Fryer, that not one person was willing to take the risk and make the sacrifice. When the activist said, you know, you could wear a mask. In fact, that might be even more effective because it would dramatize how gay people have to wear a mask to protect them. That's when John Fryer finally said, okay, I'll do it. 10 minutes of courage changed the world forever. What if John Fryer had stood firm and said no? Would his life have been better, more meaningful, more happy? No. What he did in his moment of great courage, ended up giving his life its deepest meaning and its greatest joy. It's what Jesus means in Matthew 10:39 when he says, those who lose their life will save it. But those who seek to save their life will lose it. You've probably seen, you're familiar with the classic Superman movie, right? There's a scene in the Superman movie where a young Clark Kent, still in high school, is longing to be a star player on the high school football team. He just wants to be a part of the team, a player on the football team. But in a particular game, he gets demoted from being a player to being the equipment manager. And he's despondent. He's got all of these latent supernatural powers inside of him, but he's got to hide it from all of his classmates. And as a result, he's not popular and he's not respected. And so as he's leaving the game, he's so upset. His dad puts his arm around his shoulder and he says to him, son, you're here for a special reason. I don't know what that reason is, but I know one thing. It's not to score touchdowns. The same could be said for each one of us. You're not here just to be popular and respectable. You're not here to live an easy, conventional life. You're not here to focus all of your energy on being safe and enjoying the material comforts of this life. No. God has put you here to make a difference. For some, that may take the form of becoming a foster parent. For others, it may take the form of caring for an elderly parent, to do something bold and daring, self-sacrificial, risky. For some, it may mean taking a lesser paying job in order to make more impact for good in the world. For others, it may mean standing up and acting courageously in your workplace when everybody else is ducking for cover. For others, it may mean becoming an advocate for an important cause. For others, it may mean donating a kidney. For others, it may mean daring to forgive your enemy. For others, it may mean that in a moment of crisis, you risk your life to save somebody else. We can't plan it out. All we can do is try to be ready for when our moments come. Okay, so as we start to wind down, let's think about that. How can we be ready? What is it that makes the difference between people who rise to meet their moment and those who don't? I think we find the answer in our gospel story today, in the contrast between Pontius Pilate and Jesus Christ. Remember how Jesus responded in our story when Pilate said, "Are you a king?" Jesus responded, John 18:36, by saying, "My kingdom is not from this world. If my kingdom were from this world, my followers would be fighting to keep me from being handed over. But as it is, my kingdom is not from here." Jesus' frame of reference was very different from Pilate's. All Pilate had was this material world. His kingdom was of this world. And when all you've got is the material world, your goal will be to maximize material comforts and pleasure. Because if all you've got is this short life, you gotta do the things that will protect yourself and do the things that will benefit yourself so you can get the most out of this short life. Play it safe. Don't take risks. But Jesus had a completely different frame of reference. Jesus understood that this material reality is surrounded by and bleeds in to a whole greater reality that we call eternity. Because Jesus had eternity. Because Jesus' kingdom was not just of this world, but encompassed eternity, and everything that was God's was his. Jesus had the freedom to dare to do great things for God. Risky, yes. But when everything is yours, all of time, all of eternity, all that is God's, you can afford to take some risks. And you don't just end up living for the material pleasures of this life, but you can go even deeper. What was true for Jesus is equally true for us. If we are surrounded by Spirit, and if eternity awaits us, that frees us up to take some chances doing bold, daring, beautiful things. And in the process, we not only will be building beauty into our souls for all eternity, we will simultaneously be experiencing the deepest meaning and the deepest beauty of life down here on earth. Those who lose their life will save it. There was a teenager who was working a summer job. One day out of the blue, his supervisor says to him, "Joey, do you believe in life after death?" Joey says, "Well, yeah, I guess so." The supervisor says, "Oh, okay, well then," he says, "I guess that makes it okay that you left work early yesterday to go to your grandma's funeral." Joey said, "I don't understand." His supervisor says, "Well, you see, Joey, your grandma stopped by here to visit you after you left." People who believe in resurrection have a whole different frame of reference. Believing in life after changes everything. People who believe in eternity have a different frame of reference. It changes everything. What are you living for? Is your kingdom entirely of this world? Or do you have something more going on? Yes, this world's beautiful, but it's not all there is. And the great irony is, when we open ourselves up and take risks that make no sense if this is all there is, that's when we find the deepest meaning and beauty, not just in the life to come, but in this life. Let me close with this. Picture yourself in a South African courtroom at an official session of the South African Truth and Reconciliation Commission. This hearing was being held shortly after apartheid ended. Officer Vanderbrock, a white South African police officer, was on the stand confessing his crimes. There, sitting in the courtroom, was a woman whose family had been the victim of Officer Vanderbrock's crimes. On the stand, the officer described with tears and a deep sense of remorse how years earlier he and some other white officers had gone to this woman's home and kidnapped her 18-year-old son, took him out in the woods, shot him at point-blank range, then put his body on a bonfire, turning it over and over again until it was reduced to ashes while they, the white officers, partied around the bonfire. But Vanderbrock wasn't done with his confession. He went on to confess that 8 years later, he and other officers returned to that same house and kidnapped the woman's husband and took him off into the woods bound. An hour later, Vanderbrock confessed he came back and compelled the woman to go with him to where her husband was bound. They forced her to watch as they poured gasoline on him and lit him on fire. His last words to her were, "Forgive them." Now, Officer Vandenbroek had confessed his heinous crimes and stood in the courtroom awaiting his sentence. A commissioner turned to the woman and said, "What do you want?" In a calm voice, she said, "I want three things. First," she said, "I want Officer Vandenbroek to take me to where they killed my son so I can gather up the dust and give him a proper burial. Second," she said, "Officer Vandenbroek took all my family away from me. I've still got a lot of love to give. I want Officer Vandenbroek to come to the ghetto once a month and spend a day with me so I can be a mother to him. Third," she said, "I want Officer Vandenbroek to know that God forgives him, and so do I. And I want somebody to help me across the room to where he is so that I can embrace him and he can feel that my forgiveness is real." As someone led her across the room, Vandenbroek fainted and fell to the ground, overcome. Somebody sitting in the audience began to sing quietly, "Amazing Grace." And before long, everybody was singing. What that old woman did took unbelievable courage. It takes a lot of courage to forgive your enemy. It takes a lot of courage to risk reconciliation with your enemy because it might backfire. It takes an awful lot of courage to be a peacemaker in this world. But the risk is worth it because when we live our values in both our public and private life, that's when we, ironically, find life's deepest meaning. Don't hoard your life, live your life. Don't sit there on the sidelines. Get into the fray. Dare to do bold, beautiful things for God and goodness. Don't make Pilate's mistake. He missed his moment. Let's not miss ours.